History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories right there that should not go untold. And they really don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. In the process, yeah, we're educated, we're always entertained, and it's inevitable that we're going to become inspired by the examples from our men and women in uniform. This weekend marks National Vietnam War Veterans Day, and commemorations are taking place wherever you're listening. So take this as your encouragement to get involved and get connected. We'll have the honor of hearing from one of the 9 million Americans who put on a uniform during that era. In fact, he can still fit into his flight suit. 86-year-old retired Air Force Colonel Eric Doten of Henderson, Nevada is our guest today. I know we're going to talk about flying F-4s and commanding ROTC units, even being a chancellor of a university and visiting Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. But let's go way back. Your earliest childhood memories. Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., and my father was with the government. And then when I was three, he went with the State Department, and we moved to Canada. So I spent my early years in Ottawa, Canada, outside of Ottawa. That's the first time I went to an air show, and I actually got to see airplanes. I think that's probably when I first started really being interested in the possibility of becoming a pilot someday.
Yeah, and decades later, I know you'd end up coordinating air shows, some of the best air shows. Was there a particular plane that kind of caught your eye or inspired you?
Well, I think the one that I remember the most, I remember seeing a DC-3, or it was a C-47, but a DC-3. It's a ground display at that air show, and I remember being able to walk inside it and walk up to the cockpit and seeing all the dials and gauges and things and being fascinated by it.
And I'm also just thinking about the timing of all of this. If you're 86 years old now, it means you were born right before America was drawn into World War II. And if you're 3 years old when you moved to Canada, your father's working for the State Department. I'm sure World War II was a defining time of his career. Were you aware of everything that was going on in the world as a real young boy?
Yes, I was. I was living in Canada when the war ended, too. I moved there in 1943, and we didn't leave until 1948. So, yes, I remember the war years. We had a little different rationing situation in Canada than they had in the United States, I guess, but all of us were impacted by the war. There wasn't any way to avoid it.
And do you remember any kind of celebration when VE Day or VJ Day came around, or were you too young?
I remember both of them. I was in Canada for VE Day, but we had relatives in Vermont, and we'd go south to Vermont for the summers. And I remember VJ Day as a parade in Montpelier, Vermont. So I remember that. Yeah, I do.
And I think not too long after that, your father was reassigned to one of the countries that had been liberated by the Allies in Europe, right?
Yes. We were transferred to The Hague in Holland and lived there for a couple of years. Holland recovered pretty rapidly. I remember we went over by boat, and we stopped at Le Havre in France for a few minutes to discharge passengers. And I remember feeling that France was a little slower to recover. The harbor was still kind of a mess, but even though there was still clear evidence of the war in Holland, they had done a lot. By the time we got there in 1948, they'd done a lot to ease things up. And I actually ended up going to public school in Holland and learned the language to the extent that you can when you're 8 years old, and really enjoyed it. It was one of the nicest times of my childhood was the years I spent in Holland. Made some good friends. One good friend that I met there, and he still keeps in touch with me all these years later.
And I'm just imagining, I mean, to grow up in these diverse places at such a tumultuous time in world history with a father who's kind of in the middle of it, had to give you an interesting perspective on global affairs.
Yeah, well, you understand that there are people there. You do get the feeling, the knowledge that things are going on outside of the United States, and that everybody has their own perspective of things. So you probably have a little broader view of the world than most kids growing up just in this country. So yes, it does have that impact.
Did your father share much about some of the things he was up to or what his day-to-day tasks were?
Yes, some. Plus, he, part of his job, he was the press attaché for the embassy in The Hague, and part of his duties was to stay in touch with the members of the press, and we'd have members of the press over to the house, so I got to meet quite a few people that way and listen to their talk. So, you know, I'd kind of pick things up by osmosis. So I was able to keep track of it. My father did share what he could with us. He was pretty good about that.
And there's a photo here, I guess before you went to Holland, while you were still in Canada. I don't know too many kids in grade school that have their photos taken with the United States president. What's the story behind this photo of you and Harry Truman?
Well, President Truman came to visit Ottawa in 1947 or so. He naturally was there at the embassy, and they had all the embassy kids come in to meet the president. And that's when I got my picture taken with him. But he was there as a goodwill trip to with a meeting with the Canadian government.
There have been a few presidents since then. How many more have you had the privilege of meeting?
Well, I think that was the only one I ever actually met. As a young lad, I helped campaign for Kennedy, particularly for his election to the Senate in Massachusetts back in the early 50s. But, you know, I never met any other presidents.
But you served a few of them as your commander-in-chief in a 23-year Air Force career. What was the story of how you ended up in the Air Force?
Well, when I got to college, I decided that my new roommate had joined ROTC, and so he kind of talked me into joining ROTC with him. And I wanted, the Air Force intrigued me because I still had thoughts about becoming a pilot. So I joined the Air Force ROTC. The incentive was the possibility of being able to fly aircraft. Plus, the draft was on, so being in ROTC kept you out of any risk of being drafted.
And this is the late 50s, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just trying to do the math in my head, and when I walked into your home here in Henderson, I saw a college basketball signed by the commissioner of the West Coast Conference, Stu Jackson, who used to be pretty tight with a guy by the name of Bill Bradley, and I'm guessing you were at Princeton when Bill Bradley was a big basketball star there, is that right?
No, I had already graduated when the Bradley years occurred, but I graduated in 1961, and he was there in a little bit later in the 60s. And yes, he went on to quite a career in both in politics and in basketball. I was in college from 1957 to 1961, so those were relatively peaceful years for us. Basically, it was during the Eisenhower years. My big achievement, I guess, in college was I was the student commander of the ROTC unit in my senior year.
And so the Ivy League education and the ROTC opportunity propels you into the Air Force. Did you have an idea of what you might end up flying or what you wanted to fly?
Well, actually, I got a slot to go to pilot training right out of ROTC, but I had some minor issue that arose on a physical, and so I had to do some corrections to that, and so I didn't get to go to pilot training for a couple of years after I actually got my commissioned. I ended up, because I graduated in 61, I ended up going to pilot training in 63. Before that, I was a personnel officer at Andrews Air Force Base, just outside of Washington, before I went to pilot training in Phoenix, Arizona at Williams Air Force Base.
If there's not anything here, I'm not trying to inject something, but I'm just thinking about these touch points. And you had memories of VJ Day and VE Day back in 1945. I think you were a little too young to remember Pearl Harbor Day when you were a year old, but that November 22nd, 1963, when your commander-in-chief is now you're in the Air Force and in pilot training, when he was assassinated, is that something that you have a unique memory of because of where you were and what you were doing?
Yeah, we were all totally shocked, of course, that it happened. And I was actually at lunch at the officers' club in Williams Air Force Base when they announced it, and we just couldn't believe it. It definitely had an impact on us. And then my wife and I spent the next few days watching television. And so I got to see most of the events that occurred. I saw Oswald get shot, all the other things that went on TV, listening, watching Cronkite make his statements, and watching LBJ get sworn in as the new president. So yeah, it certainly had an impact. It had an impact on everybody everybody in the country. Again, it was kind of the end of an era for a lot of us that things had been pretty quiet up to that point. We'd lived through Korea, but we hadn't started Vietnam yet. So it was still a peaceful era. I was in pilot training during a time of peace. The assassination had a pretty profound impact on all of us.
It almost seems like, I don't know if this is the right phrase or not, but that there was some innocence shattered or something along those lines?
Yes. Yeah, it was the end of an age of innocence. I think you're right. It definitely did change the mood of the country dramatically.
And so here you are, a young husband and a pilot in training. I've talked to a lot of guys who, you know, they tell me their combat stories of flying fighters or whatever they were flying, but sometimes some of the things they went through along the way to get there stand out too. Are there any memories from your progression to earning your wings that give you a chuckle or maybe even raise your eyebrows a little bit?
Well, I guess you always remember your first solo. I'd never flown an airplane before when I got to pilot training, and I started out straight into jets. So my first airplane I ever flew was a T-37, a little twin-engine jet primary trainer. You know, it took me a while to get used to the idea that was me flying an airplane. I guess, the first time I ever went to Las Vegas was when I was in pilot training. So that was my first visit.
And I imagine this city was a little different 60-plus years ago.
Certainly was. Caesars was brand new when I got there, and the city was a lot smaller, as I remember. But it was still a pretty exciting thing to have happen to you, to go to see Sin City in those days. So I've always had a kind of a warm spot in my heart for Las Vegas. And then years later, when I was instructing the Germans all wanted to go to Las Vegas on their cross-country trips. So I spent a lot of time in Vegas in the 70s. So I saw Vegas in the 60s and in the 70s. And then in the 80s, when I came back, because my stepson was out here going to UNLV, stayed in Vegas and worked in the restaurant industry and the hotel industry, and now he's the director of human relations for the city of Las Vegas.
How about that? Time flies.
Yes.
And you were flying, and the war in Vietnam starts to ramp up, but it was a while before you would get sent over there. What were some of the things that you got to do in those early years in the Air Force, and what are some of the memories that stand out?
My first assignment out of pilot training was actually to stay in the pilot training business and become an instructor in T-37s. But I moved from Phoenix to Lubbock, Texas, Reese Air Force Base, and I was a T-37 instructor there for about 5 years. That's some interesting experiences happened there. One of the first cross-country flights I took with a student, we went into Los Angeles, and we ended up having weather delays, and so we had a couple of aircraft went in ahead of us that were declaring an emergency. And I ended up having an emergency too, because I was running low on gas. And I kept telling the controllers that I didn't have a lot of time left. So they went ahead and picked me up on radar and vectored me straight into the Navy airfield in Los Angeles. They had me descend down below. It was a typical lower cloud layer over Los Angeles at the time. They descended me down underneath the cloud layer, and I broke out, and I was right over Disneyland. I look out at the side of the airplane, and I could see the Matterhorn down there. And I was thinking it would be kind of terrible to have to bail out of this airplane if it ran out of gas. And I ended up landing on the Matterhorn in a parachute. But I was lucky I had enough gas to make it to the airfield and even taxied it in safely. That was probably the most memorable thing I had from my years training people to fly airplanes. Or at least fly T-37s.
And some of those people visiting Disneyland that day might have thought it was all part of the show.
Yeah, they probably would have if I'd bailed out. Fortunately, I didn't have to.
So you're training all these pilots, and a lot of the guys that you're training are getting sent to Vietnam, and I'm sure you were very aware of some of the conditions they were facing over there.
Oh, yes. We kept pretty much aware of what was happening over there, and of course, we had a lot of guys coming back. Because it was fairly common if somebody came back from Vietnam that they would end up coming to be flight instructors there at the air bases that were conducting flight training. And so we get a lot of war stories from them. So yeah, we had a pretty good idea what was going on over there.
And when you heard those war stories, Did it make you want to get over there yourself, or make you thankful you weren't over there, or maybe both?
I think probably both. You know, we all knew that if we were going to stay in the service, that we'd be going. And I had a chance to get out of the Air Force before I ended up going to train in fighters and ended up going to Vietnam. But I decided that I wanted to make the Air Force a career. So when I did that, that kind of set the mood, and I knew that at some point I'd be going to Vietnam.
I hope this is an okay question to ask. I've heard guys opine on this. Some people have told me they got out and they wish they would have made it a career, and then I've heard the other side of the coin. Looking back now at 86 years old, how do you feel about that decision to make the Air Force a career?
I think I made the right decision. The alternative at the time, I had a couple of alternatives. One was to fly for the airlines. The other was to go to work for Perone. He was hiring an awful lot of ex-military officers to come and work for him. We all were getting barcaded with those offers, so that we had that option plus the airlines. But I still decided I wanted to stay in the Air Force, and no, I don't regret the decision at all.
And in your home here on the wall is a large picture of a mean-looking F-4 Phantom flying over the jungle in Vietnam. What was your first impression of that aircraft?
How big it was. It wasn't as handsome in some ways as some other aircraft, and the F-105 drivers, who had a pretty sleek-looking airplane, the nickname for the F-4 was Double Ugly, because it had two engines, and the F-105 and the F-100 with the bombers only had one engine, so they laughed at us for needing an extra engine.
What was your comeback to the Thud pilots?
We'd make jokes about the Thud. They were having problems because they had engine cooling problems, and so the thing would blow up sometimes. So the saying was, flaps take off, gear up, flaps up, blow up. You know, we had, that's typical military humor. Is kind of macabre sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. And maybe that takes some of the sting out of the stakes that you know you're dealing with. And I guess maybe that's a question too, from the emotional side, to leave family in the States behind and deploy to Vietnam at this point, knowing what so many of these pilots have gone through and how many have been killed or become prisoners of war. How did you navigate that emotional weight of this new task?
I went through F-4 training in Florida at Homestead Air Force Base outside of Miami. I finished pilot training just about the same time that Johnson decided to stop bombing North Vietnam. And the effect of that was that they had pilots' tours were longer than they had been. They were down to 100 missions over North Vietnam. And as soon as they stopped bombing, then they went back to the one-year mission the rest of the people in Vietnam had. So that meant they had a surplus of pilots. So they kept my whole class there at Homestead, and we became part of Stateside Tactical Air Command. So we stayed there for a couple of years. And they never did send my squadron over to Vietnam. I ended up going over separately, individually. And I ended up being, by that time I was working in the command post at Homestead, and they sent me over as an operations officer. So I didn't go over as an F-4 pilot, and I never did get to fly the F-4 in combat, which is kind of one of the few regrets I have, is that I would have liked to have been able to fly the F-4 in combat, because I'd flown it for several years, and I was pretty proficient in it, and I was a lot better prepared to go over and fly it than most people who are going into the airplane, because they were just coming right straight out of training without any real experience in the aircraft. That's kind of the way it was. I ended up going to Tan Sanut Air Force Base in Vietnam. It was the headquarters there for Air Corps 7th Air Force. And was there as an operations officer for a year.
And we're going to discuss that year in country when we come back. 86-year-old Eric Doten of Henderson, Nevada is our guest today. You can find photos and a couple brief videos with him at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I got to tell you, when it comes to your money, money? I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this weekend in which America pauses to recognize National Vietnam War Veterans Day. Retired Air Force Colonel Eric Doten is one of those Vietnam veterans. If you pull up the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find video evidence that he still fits into his flight suit all these years later. When we left off, he mentioned he spent a year in country at Tan Sanut Air Force Base in Saigon after training to fly the F-4 Phantom.
And before I ask you about that year in Vietnam, because I'm sure there's some things that you saw, you experienced, you did. When it comes to that Phantom, you said you were a lot better prepared than a lot would have been. What were some of the things you liked about that airplane and maybe even some things you didn't like?
Well, it had some bad habits as far as its controllability. If you got the nose pitch too high, people had it actually go out of control on them. You could always relieve it. If you knew what was happening, you could stay out of there, out of that regime. I'd say it was, in some ways it was a little trickier to fly than the airplane I'd been flying. After I came back from Vietnam a few years later, I ended up flying the T-38, which I had flown in pilot training, and that airplane was more predictable in some ways than the F-4 was. But I liked its power, and it was always kind of neat to be able to make afterburner climbs in the F-4, because it was, at the time, it held the world's speed record for time from 0 to 40,000 feet. You know, sometimes we'd go up over 50,000 feet just to see what it was like. When you get up over 50,000 feet, the sky starts getting a lot darker blue. It was just kind of a fun thing to do every now and then. I generally liked the airplane. As I said, it had some deficiencies as far as the handling was concerned, which they eventually solved completely when they built the F-15, which was built by the same manufacturer. And it was, I never got to fly the F-15, but I understand it was a lot easier to control than the F-4 was.
And just hearing you say you never got to fly the F-15, I'm just wondering, because I know there's some of these D models of that plane around that have a extra seat for somebody to ride along. Have you ever gotten to ride in an F-15?
Never got to ride in an F-15 or an F-16.
Would you if they offered you?
Sure. No questions asked.
And you mentioned having that F-4 had the world record for fastest from 0 to 40,000 feet. What does that feel like when you're climbing at that rapid pace? I imagine there's some things that your body is experiencing during that ascent.
Well, usually you're kind of on your back because you're going almost straight up. That's kind of the big sensation. It's like you're sitting down at an angle. People ask me what it sounds like, what it feels like to go supersonic, whether you lose all sound or anything. And you really don't, because you still have the airplane around you and it's still making a lot of noise. So the steep full afterburner climb is... It's interesting, and it's an exciting feeling, but it's one that's similar to just the feeling you have just flying the airplane in a routine manner. You just kind of have the feeling of this big hunk of metal around you. It gives you a feeling of comfort in some ways, and it has a big cockpit, so you've got a lot of room. It's one of the roomier cockpits I've ever been in.
So your time in Vietnam, it sounds like you had a maybe a unique perspective on this war, given what your role was there for a year at Tansanut and who you were interacting. You were briefing generals on a regular basis?
Yeah, every day I briefed General Clay, who was the commander of 7th Air Force, on what our plan was for the next day. Because I worked in what they call the Fragmentary Order Office, which writes out the orders and sends them out to the bases as to what missions they have and their time and everything else. All the plan for the particular day is sent out to them every day. And it's called a fragmentary order because they have a basic order that they operate under, and the fragmentary order is the daily addition to it. And I would brief the general on what that was. And we had 4-star and 3-star and several 1-star generals. And before I had briefed the 4-star, I had to brief the 1-star so he'd know what was going to happen. That was pretty much true of everything. When you were going to brief a senior officer, then you briefed one just one notch below him so that they could make their comments before you talked to the big man. But it was, I got along really well with the generals and found that they put their pants on one leg at a time just like I did.
Funny how that works. And this was after the Tet Offensive when things were real hairy. But I imagine there were still occasions where that Air Force base right there in Saigon came under enemy attack.
Yeah, we had rocket attack occasionally. It wasn't as bad. Da Nang, farther north, got hit a lot more often than we did. But we occasionally had rocket attacks. I never had any rocket come that close to me or my quarters. But you never knew when it was going to happen. And we all had helmets and flak vests, and so we were ready if anything did happen. Fortunately, the whole year I was in Vietnam, I was in Tansanut, I never had to don my helmet or flak jacket because of a rocket attack.
And did you get to do a little bit of flying over there?
I did. I spent some time flying missions over Cambodia. I was an airborne command and control person flying in an Air Force Constellation. We had it set up with the radio so I could talk to the forward air controllers who were controlling the strikes into Cambodia at the time. We'd fly over. We actually flew out of Karat Air Base in Thailand. So I went ahead and spent a couple of weeks in Thailand. I flew missions every day over Cambodia. And the Constellation is a big, comfortable airplane, but it has the engines had a certain whine to them, and so the whole airplane would shake a little bit. And I remember after I had been flying 7 days straight, I was standing at the bar at the Air Force Base in Karat, and I found myself starting to vibrate like I vibrated in the airplane, which was kind of a weird experience. And fortunately, I got a couple of days off after that, so vibration stopped. But that was an experience directing strikes into Cambodia. One morning when I got on station, the forward air controller coming on duty said that he was sent to see if he could find the remains of somebody who had been up the day before, the evening before, and had crashed. And he was able to find the wreckage. I don't think they were able to recover the pilot. Things like that happened. That was one particular incident I remember. And we always, before any target was struck, we had to go ahead and call back to the headquarters at 7th Air Force Base, which had a contingent of Cambodian officers who would give you the thumbs up or the thumbs down on a particular target. We found that they really were not that tough in their evaluations, and they normally approved virtually every target. Sometimes I'd actually find the forward air controller would go down and take a look at the target and find out that from his perspective it didn't look like it was something that we should strike, like it would be a bunch of women washing clothes by the riverside or something like that. And he said, I'm not going to make a strike on in that area. So, you know, it was an interesting couple of weeks doing that. I got a good feel for what goes on during the war during that time. The other time I flew was I flew out of Udorn Air Force Base, and we flew over in an OV-10 forward air controller over Laos. And that's the only time I actually got shot at while I was airborne. They didn't ever shoot at us when I was doing the command and control, but the control business for some reason. At least we never saw any shots. But flying the OV-10, the guy I was flying with spotted us about 25 rounds that were fired at us. Didn't hit us, but get your attention.
I would imagine so. And
for people who aren't familiar with the OV-10, maybe share some of the capabilities and purpose of that plane.
Yeah, it's a small turbo twin turboprop engine aircraft that's really pretty capable. It is armed. It actually had a 7.2-millimeter cannon, and it had rockets, of course, for marking targets, which is its primary mission, was to mark targets and control fighters coming in and dropping bombs. So it's a very maneuverable, easy to fly, fun flying little airplane.
And that's some of what you were doing, was marking targets yourself?
I was flying in the back seat, and so I got a chance to fly the airplane a little bit, but when it came to actually marking targets, the front seat guy actually did them. Actually, he had the controls to actually mark the targets, so he did that. But yeah, I was part of the mission, and so it all contributed to helping to hopefully hit targets that we meant to hit.
And you mentioned earlier, when you were flying the command and control in the Constellation, a mission where the downed aircraft, one of your fellow pilots, was located. How much did that weigh on you? How sobering was that to know about some of the casualties and families back home whose pilot was never coming back?
Well, it certainly gives you a moment of pause, for sure. And you do, it does strike you, certainly hits you at the time that you find out about it. Just like I had a lot of friends that I knew when I was in pilot training or as an instructor who ended up not coming home, and that always struck me too. And I always, when I'm in Washington, I go and look up their names on the Vietnam Memorial, which is quite an experience. And that's one of the things I got to see again when I was at went on the honor flight last October.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you about that. I guess before we wrap up your time in Vietnam, I was looking at some of the decorations you were awarded in a 23-year Air Force career, retiring as a colonel. You've got the Legion of Merit, a Bronze Star, Meritorious Service Medal, Air Force Commendation Medal. Any of those for some of the things that you did while you were over in Vietnam?
Yeah, the Bronze Star was my award for being in Vietnam for a year. It wasn't for any specific task, but just all the things I did came together. And it was not an uncommon award for people who spent a year there, but it wasn't for a specific heroic act.
I'm guessing the Air Force Commendation Medal came for something specific you did.
Yeah, I got the Commendation and Meritorious Service Medal. I got two Commendation Medals. One was after I'd finished pilot training, and I was an instructor after I finished the tour as an instructor. The Meritorious Service Medal, I believe, came after I was at Homestead Air Force Base as a command post controller. There wasn't any one specific act I can point to. It's something that a lot of these awards are given to you because you did a good job and they wanted to recognize you.
And as I'm thinking about the honor flight, I'm thinking about the juxtaposition of coming back to Las Vegas after the honor flight with Vietnam. So let's talk about that homecoming from Vietnam first. What was it really like when you came back from a year over there in Vietnam?
Well, all the stories you hear about how they treated us are true as far as I can remember. And when I flew home, they told us that we shouldn't wear our uniforms because it attracted a lot of negative attention, and they were throwing things at soldiers coming home and yelling at them. And, that was really a weird feeling not to be welcomed home. Everything you hear about it is pretty much true. That part of it wasn't a good feeling. It was, of course, great to be home again, be able to go get a hamburger and things that you really hadn't had an opportunity to do that much of in Vietnam. But it was no fun being scorned after you'd spent a year over there for your country.
Risking your life and having friends who paid the ultimate price. And anything else I didn't ask you about with regard to your time in Vietnam that has some significance to you now?
I made a couple of enjoyable trips to give briefings. One of the more interesting ones I had was when I went to the Gulf of Tonkin and briefed an admiral on the aircraft carrier out there, and I got to spend a few days and watch flight operations, and I found that pretty exciting, watching aircraft land and take off out of the carrier. That was an experience that I particularly enjoyed, and I flew over there with the, we had a Navy liaison officer at 7th Air Force, and he flew me over there in one of their little carrier delivery aircraft, and he let me fly it on the way home, and I went ahead and made the landing at Tansanute. I landed it like an Air Force pilot would. I didn't land it like a Navy pilot, so I didn't slam it into the ground. And he was amazed at how soft I could land the airplane, because they didn't do it that way. Anyway, that was one memorable experience.
You didn't have a tail hook you had to catch, huh?
No, I didn't have to. Didn't have to the tail hook. Although I had to ride through it when we landed on the carrier, and we didn't get catapulted off. We made what they call a deck takeoff, because the aircraft gained speed fast enough and is light and is small enough, so that we were able to just take off right off the deck, like the old-fashioned days before they actually had the catapult systems.
And I know there was more than a decade left in your Air Force career after you came home from Vietnam, but while we're on that topic of coming home from Vietnam and what you described and, you know, being told not to wear the uniform, let's fast forward now to all these years later, more than a half century later, when you visit Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. I'm sure there are a few things of that journey that were meaningful for you. What can you tell us about that experience?
You know, I had seen most of the memorials myself because I had been stationed at the Pentagon. It was my last tour in the Air Force was at the Pentagon, and I actually had seen the Vietnam Memorial right after it opened up, because I used to go running every day at lunch, and we'd run down to the mall from the Pentagon and saw them putting up the memorial. So I had seen the memorial before, but it was something I always cherished, the opportunity to go back to see that again. And I had not seen the Korean War Memorial, and that was an honor too, to see that. So it was good to go back and to be with all the other veterans, that a lot of whom had never been to Washington, had never seen the various memorials. So that was probably the nicest thing. And also, I had my son and grandson were able to join me for a lot of the tours, so that was an exciting part too. For me, it was very rewarding personally, but it was also an honor to be able to see the gratitude and the enjoyment of all the other honorees that were with me. So I'd call it a really memorable experience.
And oftentimes, when I'm talking to veterans, who, you know, and almost without fail, so many veterans are real hesitant to accept this free trip to Washington, and they always tell me, well, somebody else deserves it more. I'll let someone else go first. Or maybe I have seen some of these memorials before. And I always say, well, it sure is different experiencing it with all these other vets.
Yes, that is probably the biggest difference, is that you're there as part of a team of people that know what all this means. And so we all appreciated. We appreciated it as a group. When we were there, they had the National Guard was there, because the president had ordered the National Guard to keep an eye on things in Washington. They were all stationed at all the memorials, particularly the World War II memorial. And I actually had pictures taken with them. And that was also one of the nice rewarding things, some of the memorabilia that I have as a result of the visit, particularly the pictures that we were able to take of us at the various memorials.
And one memorial that wasn't there when you were stationed at the Pentagon in the 80s is the Air Force Memorial. Was that an inspiring or memorable stop for you?
I think that's one of the more dramatic of the memorials, because it's very tall and it more or less depicts spiraling aircraft going upwards. I enjoy it very much, but I had seen it before. But yes, that was quite an experience as well.
One element of that Honor Flight experience for Eric Doten was a little more emotional than others, and it's on the hearts and minds of so many this weekend as we mark National Vietnam War Veterans Day. I'm talking about the wall with more than 58,000 names, Gold Star heroes who never got to come home. We'll turn to that topic when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 86-year-old retired Air Force Colonel Eric Doten of Henderson, Nevada. Big thanks to Belinda Morse and Honor Flight Southern Nevada for connecting us to Mr. Doten, who really savored his Honor Flight experience last October.
And you mentioned the wall. And every year, these last few years, at the end of March, we have National Vietnam Veterans Day. 58,000 names are on that wall. You mentioned you knew some of these guys. Can you help us understand the emotions you experience while you go to each one of those names on that slab of black granite?
Yeah, I find myself remembering them and remembering little things about them. I always wonder how their families are doing now, because I knew their families too. So it's a very emotional experience for me. It's a moment of memories every time I go to the wall.
And if it's too personal, I don't want to pry. I'm just wondering if maybe you can give us an example of a name or two that when you see it on the wall, it still brings back that face or a time when you were together or something that comes to mind.
Well, the one I remember the most is Bob Belcher, who was a classmate of mine when we went through pilot training together. We also served together as instructors. So I had known Bob for years. One of my students, Wadsworth, was one of my good. He's one of my really good students, and he ended up going over there in an F-4. So I remember, I remember for the first time I flew him, he got airsick when he had his very first flight in the T-37, and I said, "Well, you're going to have to get over that, because otherwise you're not going to be able to go through this program." And he just gutted it out, and I don't know if he was taking pills or anything, but he managed to control himself. And I always think of that as well as how good he was when I see his name on the wall. So those are a couple people that are particularly important to me.
And do you know what happened to him over there, or what the circumstances of their ultimate sacrifices were?
I don't remember the details of Wadsworth, but Bob Belcher was lost on a night mission, and they didn't find him for a long time. He was MIA for a couple of years before they actually were able to recover him and bring him home again. I don't know the details of either of their final missions. Never did find out.
But you know the price they paid. And again, I don't want to suggest anything that's not there, but I'm just curious. When you look at those names, maybe even rub your finger across their names on that wall, is there part of you that says, if timing or circumstances were a little different, that could have been me?
I never really thought of it that way, but I can understand how you could feel that. That didn't particularly hit me for some reason, but I know a lot of people do have that sensation. They say, well, boy, there but for the grace of God.
Amen. And that was part of your experience in Washington with Honor Flight. And then you have the journey home. And I imagine there might be some memorable moments even on the flight back here to Vegas. And what was waiting for you when you landed?
Yeah, what was waiting for when we landed was really amazing. I have to admit, I was really impressed by the response that the people in this community had towards us coming home. It was very, very touching. And I really felt good about it. I had my stepson was my guardian on the trip, and both of us were overwhelmed really by the response that we received when we came back. And the other thing is, on the way home, we get to, on the flight back, they handed us out a bag of letters that people had sent to us. And reading all those letters on the flight on the way home was also an amazing experience. I'm really thankful that so many people cared. And that's one of the neat things about the Honor Flight, is that it does arouse some very positive feelings in people that don't go there and don't even know the people that they're honoring. But yes, it's one of the neater parts of the trip is coming home.
And I'm just wondering if that whole experience, all these years, I mean, you've been out of the military for more than 40 years at this point when you go on the Honor Flight. Did that experience change at all your perspective on your own service or your view of what it meant to the rest of us?
Well, I think it reawoken what I had felt before. And yes, it definitely is a way of getting you to reflect back on your service and what it meant to you and what it means to you now. You know, I'm proud to have been an Air Force pilot and had an opportunity to serve my country. And I think that it's important that people continue to do that. The country still needs people to put on the uniform and be willing to take on the risks that go with it. I hope that we're able to keep doing that and that people keep doing it voluntarily. I like the idea that we're an all-volunteer force now. I always thought that the draft was unnecessary at the end, and by the time they finally eliminated the draft, I felt that was a very solid move, and we've been able to keep our services pretty well filled despite the fact that we didn't force people to go, which is... It's a good thing. I think a country should be defended by volunteers.
There's a different level of investment there for sure, and I'm thinking of that. I have the privilege of meeting a lot of Air Force Academy cadets who are playing sports for USAFA, and my nephew just graduated there last year, is hoping to become a fighter pilot. What advice would you have for the aspiring pilots in our Air Force today?
Take very seriously what you're doing, and... work to be the best you can, because we need you, and we need you to be able to do your job correctly. So make sure that you know how to do it correctly. But I also want to tell you that it's a really enjoyable experience. Flying airplanes is a great experience, and so don't look at it as just as a job. Look at it as a way of life, in a way.
One thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing some stories that help us understand a little more the price that's been paid for our freedom. I realize we talk a lot about your year in Vietnam, but you had a lot of time before that and then a lot of time after that. And we probably came a lot closer to the end of the world in the years after Vietnam, when you were still in the Air Force and the Cold War was raging. Anything from the rest of your time in an Air Force career that went 23 years retiring as a colonel that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I had some good assignments afterwards. My probably the most memorable feeling I have is when I came home from Vietnam, I was sent to Air University to be an instructor at Maxwell Air Force Base in Squadron Officer School, which is a junior level training academy. Did that for several years, and then I went back into the Air Training Command as a T-38 instructor. And I was sent to Shepherd Air Force Base, where I got a chance to fly in a rather unique unit. It was a unit that was largely sponsored as a result of the German Air Force. We trained the Germans and Americans in Wichita Falls at Shepherd Air Force Base in T-37s and T-38s, and I was flying T-38s. And while there, I got an opportunity to be the commander of the T-38 squadron, which was a real experience. I found that command is something I enjoyed doing, and that I had some capabilities at. And anyway, after I left Shepherd, I ended up going to run an ROTC detachment in Florida at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach. That was also a very memorable experience, a chance to influence future leaders in the Air Force. And when I finished that, I went to War College and got promoted, and then went to the Pentagon and finished my last years in the Air Force as a Pentagon officer, serving in the board structure as a member of the Program Review Committee, which evaluated and did the final touches to the Air Force budget every year. So that was quite an experience as well. When I finished that, I was scheduled to go back to training command business and be the commander of the base in Phoenix at Williams Air Force Base, the same base that I had gone through pilot training in. So that would have been a nice, another nice final experience, but that didn't work out for one reason or another. I went ahead and decided that since I wasn't able to accept that position, I was going to go ahead and retire. And about the time I thought about that, I got an offer from Embry-Riddle University, where I'd been the ROTC commander, and so I ended up going back to Embry-Riddle, back to Daytona Beach, and serving as the chancellor of the campus at Daytona Beach, a period of about 10 years, and finally retired from that. And after finally retiring, that's when I did a lot of work with air shows and ran some air shows and got involved in the Air Show Professional Association, and actually was the president of that association for a number of years. And we always had our annual reunions here in Las Vegas at the old Riviera. And then later we moved to the Rio. So that was an experience in itself. Then I finally retired and went back and was living in St. Augustine. I moved to St. Augustine then and got bored with being just retired. So I went. They needed school bus drivers, so I volunteered to be a school bus driver, and I drove the school bus for about 5 years in St. John's County, driving special education kids. When I was done with that, I went ahead and moved to Las Vegas, and I've been here in Vegas at Henderson ever since, enjoying it immensely. So that kind of wraps up my career.
Well, and I can tell you're volunteering to drive the school bus for the special education students was meaningful to you, because you have a school bus model displayed just as prominently as the aircraft there in your office. What was so satisfying about that duty?
Well, feeling you were doing something good for kids that needed help, and also getting to, if you drive a special ed bus, you actually pick the kids up at their house. You don't pick them up on a street corner like you do with the general education buses. So I got to meet their parents and got to know their families, and so the relationship between me and the students that I was driving was pretty real, and it included their whole families. So that was really special, I think. And that was probably the most rewarding part of it.
And I just have to ask, because, you know, the air show world, a lot of our listeners have gone to a lot of air shows, and they get excited hearing the sound of a P-51 or seeing a F-35 now do something that other planes can't do. I'm sure it's hard to pick one or two, but are there some planes or people or experiences from your time in air shows that you're just really thankful you had?
Yeah, some of the friends I made in the air show industry I kept for years, and unfortunately I lost a couple of them. Some of the ones I knew the best were the ones that didn't make it. The air show industry is not a risk-free industry by any stretch of the imagination. They're all the people that fly those airplanes you see are true professionals, and they work very hard at their craft to make sure that you see a good show and that they're safe. And sometimes things just happen, particularly when you're flying an airplane fast, close to the ground. But it's an emotional experience, of course, losing close friends in any environment, whether it's the Air Force or whether it's the air show industry or any other time. So be thankful of the friends you have and that they're still with you.
Amen. I've just got a couple more questions, and one just out of curiosity. As you're coordinating these air shows and you're seeing all these unique aircraft, is there one plane that you always kind of wished you would have had the chance to fly?
Yeah, I always wanted to fly the F-15. That was probably the one. And I've always been fascinated by the P-51 Mustang. There were a couple of people that were flying those in air shows, and I always thought that would have been a great airplane to fly.
And I'm thinking, too, as the nation pauses for National Vietnam Veterans Day, you had a unique window on the big picture, briefing generals and all that at Tonsonute, and you also got into the nitty-gritty flying those command and control missions and forward air controller missions. What do you think those of us today, as we mark this observation of Vietnam Veterans Day, how should we view guys like you who risked your lives over there, and especially the 58,000 who didn't come home.
Well, you know, we were just doing our job, and so I guess you can appreciate us for that we did our job and we went to a war that wasn't that popular a war, and it wasn't that popular when we came home, and yet we were able to make it through, and we ought to remember that this is what I hope people remember on Vietnam Memorial Day, is that there are still a lot of veterans, a lot of Vietnam veterans out there that are still hurting, and they ought to make sure that we provide them what they need in terms of care and a place to stay. I feel terrible when I see veterans, homeless veterans. I think that's one of the biggest shames of this country, is that we allow homeless veterans to exist at the levels that they do. We also should remember, when we remember Vietnam veterans, is that is not the way to treat people. That's not the way to treat people when they come back from an engagement. And thank goodness the troops coming back from the Middle East have been treated an awful lot better than we were, and I really appreciate that. And I want people to remember that there's a right way and a wrong way to deal with veterans, and please remember and do it the right way.
I'm thinking about your time in the air, whether it was in Vietnam or here stateside or wherever. You told us about almost having a bailout over Disneyland. But there any other moments in the cockpit that you look back on and say, you know, that was kind of a close call, and I'm glad it worked out the way it did?
I was lucky. I didn't have too many close calls. I had a couple occasions where I had some smoke in the cockpit and had to come home early. You know, I had a couple of engine flameouts, but I had two engines, so that wasn't too bad, and I was able to get them restarted. I was fairly lucky. I didn't have too many bad experiences flying airplanes. In fact, I enjoyed it. I have to tell you, it's really fun to fly an airplane in and around and out of clouds. You know, little puffy cumulus clouds you see during the summer. They're really a lot of fun to go zooming in and out of. So flying can be a lot of fun. In addition to being a job and a serious job, it's a wonderful feeling that you're in control of a big machine and it's taking you through the air and giving you good feelings.
One question I know is not always easy to answer, but I think it gives the rest of us perspective. You've got 86 years in your rearview mirror. When you take stock of all the things you've done, the places you've been, the people you've known, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Making through it. I'm certainly happy for that. And I'm proud of the job that I did when I was in the Air Force and since then. So I feel like I've had a fruitful life. I enjoy my memories, and I enjoy being with the people that I'm with now. So it's all good.
And I know you're far from done, and you're very active here in Henderson, Nevada, and probably have a lot you're looking forward to. So I'm just curious, is there anything you haven't done yet in 86 years that is still on your list that you'd like to check off at some point?
Yeah, there's some traveling I'd like to do that I'm going to take a cruise from Spain to Italy next month. That's something I'm looking forward to. And the month after that, I'm going to go to my 65th college reunion, which is kind of a unique experience. And we still have half of our class there, and they're still going to be honoring our old alma mater.
And is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you think is important for us to know or understand?
Well, I want people to appreciate the families of military veterans, because the families put up with an awful lot. The hours that you have to put in and the travel that you have to do and the separations that that a military career causes. And I'm not sure that people appreciate veterans' families as much as they should. And I appreciate it, Paul. It's kind of good to go back down through memory lane like this. And I thank you for stopping by and asking me these questions. Give me a chance to say a few things.
As always, the honor and the privilege are ours. Eric Doten, retired Air Force Colonel. Don't forget to pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook and see him in that flight suit that still fits all these decades later. And we hope you can join us again next time on Hometown Heroes, when we'll be reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.